Bonjour et bienvenue dans un autre épisode de Et c'est juste un fantasme. Je suis votre host, Jordi Bailey.
And on his very confused, forgetful vampiric friend Duncan Nicol, what on earth was that?
Duncan, in honor of Empire the Vampire, I will occasionally just be sprinkling random French words into this episode of It's Just His Fantasy. I hope you're okay with
that. Almost certainly am not, but I have very little power to stop you.
Unfortunately, my GCSE French skills have not risen to the level of being able to tell you to suck it, but I will do the best I can, mon ami.
That was my GCSE French. I know oui and I know bonjour. I did not do well. I didn't even sit GCSE French.
And you mispronounced bonjour. Hello and welcome to another episode of It's Just Fantasy. I'm your host, Jordi Bailey, and this time we are revisiting a lost episode. This was supposed to be episode 3 of the podcast, but I hadn't really figured out editing by that point, and we lost the audio, and we did Elric of Menibane instead.
Exactly. So welcome to our fortnightly podcast, where me and Jordi taking turns to pick a fantasy book to read and review. And like Jordi just said, we are technically doing a revisit this time. We did read Empire of the Vampire many moons ago.
Well, now we are revisiting. This is a very special episode because Empire of the Damned, its sequel, has just come out. We're both very excited to read it, but only one of us is willing to really, like, reread the whole thing. So I've read it through, and I'm going to tell Duncan what happened in it.
It's been a long time.
And I'm going to catch you guys up too so we can enjoy the sequel together.
I hope when you kind of recount it to me, it all comes like flooding back. It's like, it's there, I think. It's just the floodgates are just locked. I just need you to just buy a little bit of a key and hopefully it'll all come out, or it won't. And I'll be like, who's that? What's going on? Dear God, I'm not prepared for the sequel.
You'll be more confused than ever.
But Jordi, before we dive into it, have you read anything else other than Empire of the Vampire? It's a big book, so thank you for taking on the load. Get anything else in on the way?
Actually, yes. I've read a lot of stuff. I mean, for one thing, I've already gone cracking on Empire of the Damned. And more so than that, in our previous episode, we talked about all of the books we've revisited so far. And one, you know, it caught in my mind. And that was First Rider's Call, the sequel to Green Rider. Because you said, Jordi, did you ever get round to reading the next book like you said you were going to? And I had to admit that I hadn't. Until now. Because I have started reading The High King's Tomb.
Oh, I am interested. Jordi, what is the scouting report? What have you spied in that tomb?
Well, listen. It's early days. I'm only a couple of chapters in. But I have to say, as much as we always talk about how much we like those books, I had forgotten how fucking cool Kerrigan Galavian is as a protagonist. To set the scene, Duncan, I realize now that this is like absolutely like the best book to read for adult female fans of fantasy novels, because it has a cracking adventure, but also the opening chapters are her like sort of bemoaning the fact that a king told her that he loved her, but then ended up with another woman, and then she gets sent a very pretty dress, and then she wears that pretty dress, and everyone talks about how pretty she is, and then she has a sword fight with a dashing man in a silk mask, who, after he, like, bests her because she's stuck in her corset, he takes off his glove, kisses it, throws it at her feet, and uses his sword to, like, pop the top button on her bodice, and then clambers out the window, only for her to throw a shoe and hit him in the head.
I mean, one, that sounds incredible. You are selling this book well.
Cracking opening.
Two, I don't know what that says, what you think about adult women readers, but thank you for telling us. I still think it sounds great.
What I'm saying is they know what's good.
That's awesome to hear. Well, I can't wait for you to get the full report in. I'm genuinely quite a bit more excited now. Jordi, do you want to know what I've been reading?
Yeah, sure, why not?
I say this in trepidation because I know you will shame me for this.
Now I'm intrigued.
I've read more Star Wars.
Ah, I am judging you for this. Shame, shame.
I have read the first book in the Star Wars, canon Star Wars High Republic series, Light of the Jedi.
I've seen that around a bunch because I keep going into Forbidden Planet to buy manga, and they have a whole section of Star Wars novels now, and I've seen that it all like stems from this one book. Is that the one with a Wookiee Jedi in the cover?
It is indeed. It's the first book that kind of kickstarts this new, I don't know really what to call it. So in kind of canon Star Wars, there was this like big complaint when the sequel trilogy was coming out. People would be like, oh, it's really annoying. Because of the movies, like the books can't do anything. The big events have to happen in the movies. So what the publishers did, they went, okay, what we'll do, we're just going to wholesale go and focus on a, like a distant time period. And that way we'll have like the creative freedom and give that to our authors. And what they settled on is the High Republic, is what they call it. So it's like 400 years before The Phantom Menace. And it's meant to be like the Jedi are like peak. You know, they are powerful. They're the agents of good going out into the galaxy.
Mm.
And that's okay. But I don't know what to say, Geordie. It has some cool ideas. It was a bit dull, to be honest. Because do you know like the Jedi in like the prequels? It's just a lot of them. I like my Han Solo types. I like my rogues and smugglers.
Sure, a lot of boring, stuffy monks.
Yeah, and like they try and give them a bit more fun, a bit more character, but I always feel like it's they're fighting against the archetype they need to embody. And like there's all these like Jedi Padawans who are like, Master, I'm going to go and be reckless, and the Master goes, it is unwise to be reckless. Please be slow and careful.
No, and, do not be cool and fun.
And then there will be an action scene. The villains are these sort of marauding space Viking types who are cool, but they're not like a galaxy-wide threat. They don't, at least they didn't feel it to me. And in every scene, there would, multiple times throughout this book, there'd be a moment where one of the Jedi Masters would be like, I am now going to go against all my teachings. Do not do this, but I will be cool for a few seconds. But I might die in the attempt, so you do not get a moral lesson. And like it worked, and it was cool, and I did enjoy it. And there were some climaxes, particularly the villain character. There's one character that I did enjoy doing, like this last stand. But it sort of also struggled because there's like, well, there's not really a main character. It's more of like a collection of Jedi. It was really up and down. Like, it wasn't a bad experience, but it was definitely sort of a 5 out of 10 for me. Just like, all right. So apparently the next books are better, but I don't know why I would go and spend my time reading them. Something that is worth reading, though, I really want to drop this in here. She Who Waits. Geordie, have you ever heard of Daniel Polansky?
No, I have not.
We are going to do this book series one day. It's called Lowtown. I've just read the third one. The first one is called Straight Razor Cure. And Geordie, everything, when I recommended Gutter's Prayer, a book that we reviewed nearly 2 years ago and ranked quite low on our top 50 in our last episode.
Which you can hear in our previous episode.
This is everything that that book sort of should have been when it comes to like a gritty urban fantasy.
Mm.
I really enjoy it. We follow that kind of noir detective. I'm not going to lie, when I describe it, it sounds a lot like the Dresden Files. But give it more of a Victorian twist to it.
Sure, steampunky, dishonored-y, that sort of thing.
That kind of thing, and I think this is a really great book series where we follow a really kind of morally grey main character, and fundamentally I think it blends both fantasy elements, but still has like a solid kind of detective narrative to it that sort of works on its own, and is only kind of complemented when the fantasy is sort of brought into it. Lovely series,
well,
I do
that's
recommend.
Good, I hope... All right, maybe we'll visit that on a podcast in the future. I remember one more thing. Speaking earlier of Elric, I have dipped my toes back into the Citadel of Forgotten Myths, the latest Elric story. I bounced off of it a number of times over the past 2 years, but since finishing Elric, I now finally get enough of the world to actually understand what the fuck is happening, because it takes place after, like, the Flamebringers, and... I mean, it takes place after the Flamebringers, but you need to have read Stormbringer to actually get it. Like, there's literally a bit where someone says, this is what happens at the end of Stormbringer. And Elric says, that hasn't happened. What are you talking about? Because this character can, like, see the future or something. And so, very confusing if you haven't read Stormbringer. Now I have, and now I get it. He also references whatever the fuck happens in the Moonbeam Roads, which I have not read, and probably never will. But I just looked past and was like, this is not important. I'm not going to think about the Moonbeam Roads. So I'm slowly making my way through the Citadel of Forgotten Myths.
Well, I'll wait for your full report. It's hard. No matter how much I really love Moorcock and Elric, I've always just been a bit hesitant pushing deeper into the series, because I've not always heard the most glowing things. But if you like it, maybe I'll give it a go. But
yeah, we'll find out. We got to find out how much weird shit lies in here. Is he going to fight Adolf Hitler? Who knows? Maybe.
Elric isn't the pale soul stealer that we're here to talk about today, though, is he? Segue into the book
of
the week.
He's not the pale soul stealer with a magical talking sword, which is a bit odd, and who has a moniker in which an animal is compared to a colour. No. And he's addicted to drugs.
We're talking about our favourite silver saint, Gabriel, in Empire of the Vampire.
Yeah, yeah. So, Empire of the Vampire. For those of you who have not read it before, and you've listened to that title and you've said, that sounds a bit silly and goth, you're right. It is quite silly, and it is very goth, and you just gotta roll with those punches, baby. I really like Empire of the Vampire. Duncan, looking back, you remember enjoying it as well, don't you?
I really do. It definitely had a silliness to it. It took itself seriously in places it probably shouldn't, but it genuinely kept my attention. Although it was quite a beefy book, it had a good run of its action. It had sort of these two plot lines I vaguely remember, one with a hunt for the Holy Grail when he's like a bit older, and one when he's younger in a training school, and they run parallel. And I remember it jumps back and forth and it worked well. It was good.
Empire to Vampire, in a short sentence, is a story about a world where the sun has been blocked out, and vampires, with the lack of a true day, are free to roam the earth and slowly take it over. It presents a world full of like darkness and danger, and the only bastion against that darkness is the power of faith. The church is the main power in the world, and it's basically, you know, fantasy Catholicism. There's a lot of Catholicism in this book, and a lot of characters talking about God, and they even have, like, their own Jesus character. But the main character spends most of the book as kind of an edgy atheist. The thing which you gotta know about Empire of the Vampire is that it's basically a series of vampire jokes. For example, the framework of the story, Duncan's mentioned the fact that there are two plot lines which run parallel, and they jump back in and forth, you know, what story is Gabriel telling? But it's all being told through dialogue to you by Gabriel in an interview with a vampire. You know, there's a joke being made that, you know, about the movie Interview with a Vampire, but this time it's the vampire giving the interview. The vampiric historian, Jean-François Chastain, has captured Gabriel. He's already lost in the framework of a story. The first thing they tell you is that he's a killer, he defeated the main bad guy, and he's going to be executed, and he lost. Everything he tried to do, he failed at. He lost the Grail, humanity's going to die out, vampires would rule and destroy the world, and there's nothing he can do about it except tell his story. And so, in this interview, we hear his account of his early life, how he became a silver saint, and the greatest silver saint, how he fell from grace, how he found the Grail, how he lost it, and how he doomed humanity. That's the story of Empire to Vampire.
I mean, I can tell you now, Geordie, as someone who has not reread this, I can remember, like, the most sort of, like, the beginnings and the ends. I'm like, yeah, I remember there was Day's death, and I can remember there was a school. Mm-hmm. I can't remember who was at the school. And to be honest, do you know what really sticks out in my mind? Like, two things. One is referencing the very end. I remember the end, and I remember the dilemma, and I remember comparing it to The Last of Us. Not saying it originated it, but that was what made us think of it. And I just remember one thing that just sticks out more than anything else from this book. It's just a little detail. And that was the fact that in this world, vodka's really cheap because you can still grow potatoes in low light, but whiskey's expensive because wheat is harder to grow.
That's, yeah, you got it, man. That's the most important thing. But part, a big part of this, the existence in this world is just that it's kind of shit. When the sun has kind of gone out, and this is something I didn't notice until this read-through, right from the start, like in chapter 2, when he starts telling his story, he says, no one knows what day's death is. The sun is still there, but it's like a bloody red, and it's not very bright, which means that vampires don't get burned when they go out in the day. They're still weaker, but they don't get burned. And plants fail, and all the forests died. And because of that, all the like big animal predators died. So only small animals are left. And people are just basically starving most of the time and eating potatoes and mushrooms to survive. I can't remember where I was going this. Oh, but, he says, some people say, like, it's a curse from God. Some people think the vampires did it. And some people think, like, on the other side of the planet, a meteorite hit and covered the world in ash. And I was like, oh shit, there literally might actually be a completely normal explanation for this. And I had never considered that. I genuinely thought it had to be magic, but it might not be.
I think that's a really important point, though, is that even the villains of the piece, far as we're aware, didn't cause this. It's like, it just happened and people are taking advantage of it.
That's part of actually what I really like about this aspect of the book I didn't appreciate before. This book has a lot of fun playing with the mythology of vampires. A lot of stuff in it, it's very standard stuff. They can't go into buildings without being invited. There's no explanation as to why that's the case. You know, why can't they do that? Who knows? It's just the rules. They can't cross running water. Well, if they're very powerful, they can cross running water, but running water is like acid. You know, if they go in, they melt, which is much like them getting caught in a sunbeam. But there's also this really nice element I hadn't clocked before. They have like categories of vampire. They have like, there are high bloods, which are like the standard, typical, intelligent, powerful vampires. And the older they get and the more people they eat, the stronger they get. That's all pretty standard. You'd see that in a lot of different, you know, stuff. You know, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I've been watching that a lot over the past couple of years, slowly making my way through that. And yeah, that's pretty typical. But in this, J. Christoph was like, I kind of also want vampires to be zombies. Like, I really want them to be like fodder who you can like slash and rip apart with a sword. And that's where the wretched come in. And the wretched is basically, this is great explanation as to why when vampires kill people, sometimes they rise as vampires and sometimes they don't. And the answer is, when a vampire kills someone, they always come back as a vampire. But the time it takes for them to come back varies a lot. And if they come back in like a couple of hours, they are fresh. But if it's just a couple of days or even a week, they rot and their brain rots. So instead of rising as a hale, hearty, powerful vampire, they rise as a mindless killing machine. And the reason why vampires hadn't taken over the world to begin with is that most of the time they rise as the wretched. And then they're too stupid to hide when the sun comes out. So they got burnt. Only Day's Death. Day's Death doesn't just mean vampires can rule the world. It means that their foot soldiers aren't being destroyed. That's the key difference, and I really appreciated that.
Do you know, I genuinely don't remember that, like, at all. And I suppose it's really nice, because I get the idea, because, like, vampires having their minions, their thralls, isn't a new idea, and I certainly hear the idea of vampires creating, I don't know, whites or lesser beings, but often it's like a separate category. They're like, oh no,
yeah,
I did some dark magic and created these.
Absolutely. You know, Castlevania, Dracula is like this big threat and he can summon monsters, but in that series you have to invent, like, well, I have to give Dracula like special different powers to explain why he has all these monsters fighting for him. But in this, there's a very clear, consistent power system. And speaking of power systems, it's really enjoyable the way it breaks down vampires into, like, different bloodlines and says, well, why can vampires control animals? Why can they read minds? Well, actually, no. Only some vampires can read minds, and some can control animals, and they're different bloodlines of vampires. These different kin have developed these powers, and they share them by spreading their blood. That's a cool idea. I like that a lot. And you even get the Edward Cullen vampires and the Divock, where they're superhumanly strong. They can lift like 2 tons.
And I also just like the fact that the vampires themselves don't have like complete control. It's not like they can pick you or turn
you. That's right.
They're just sort of going about their way, and whether or not someone rises behind them is sort of like, well, it happens sometimes.
I don't want to get stuck just on vampires. I think we should actually talk about the book itself. So the vampires in the book, they're cool, they're scary, they're dangerous. That makes them work as antagonists. And that means they have to be defeated. And who the fuck is going to fight the vampires when they're so much stronger? And this is where we get into some edgy, fun shit. Like, you have to just be on board with some good goth dark fantasy, because the people who are fighting the vampires and are the best at fighting the vampires are the bastard children, the bastard sons of half-human, half-vampires who were born of human mothers to vampiric fathers who are addicted to blood like drug addicts and have to cook up vampire blood, put it in a pipe and smoke it, to which they are explicitly addicted to, in a bizarre fusion of dark, sanguineous horror and religious ecstasy.
I mean, I remember powdered blood being...
Yes, exactly.
And is it the idea that vampires, like, their blood is already run dry, so that every time they make a kill, they have to, like, just scrape it out?
Well, that's actually, I'm impressed that you remembered that, but yes, basically, yeah, vampires' hearts don't beat, so when they hunt and kill a vampire, it's much harder for them to extract blood from the vampire than it is for the vampires to extract blood from humans. There's another thing that J. Christoph was, like, really clever in thinking about. There's a scene early in the book where Gabriel, in the present, well, not the present, in the Grail Quest part of the book, you know, when he's a grown man and he's not a boy, he kills a vampire and he opens up her chest and he grabs her heart and he pumps it with his hand to extract blood from her into vials so that he can smoke her blood later.
Cool.
Yeah, it's dope.
But if that's your reaction, that's got to be your reaction, I think, to really get into that. You're like,
absolutely.
Yes.
Actually, that's a great point, Duncan. I think bullet time. I'm just going to hit you and the audience with some stuff in the book that's out there, and you've just got to like it, okay?
Okay, go.
So, the Order Argent, the Silver Order of Saint-Michel, are the vampire hunters. You know, they're half vampires. They train to fight vamps. They have the special powers from their fathers. And they have tattooed into their skin. They don't wear armor, because there's no point fighting superhumanly strong enemies in armor. Instead, they have silver tattoos, which are tattooed all across their body, which glow with the power of faith. And that's what protects them from vampires. They have cool, edgy tattoos covering their whole bodies, so that vampires are blinded by the power of faith.
And that's not something that gets particularly deep explanations, particularly when we're following like an atheist sort of character. The exact mechanisms of what faith is or what you're believing. Tell me if I got this wrong, but if I remember rightly, at some point they talk about it's about just having faith and not necessarily faith in anything in particular.
Yeah, towards the end of the book, his friend Aaron tells him, it matters not what you believe in, Gabriel, but you must believe in something. And that's the thesis for the book going forward. That's like his arc, is he has his faith in God has been broken, and he's lost, and he's despondent, and he wants to die, basically. But through the course of the story, he finds new reasons to live, and he starts to change, and in doing so, up to this point, Gabriel is a huge jerk. Throughout half the book, he's an absolute bastard. He's constantly rude to the people who are kind to him. He's selfish. He's manipulative. He uses people for his own ends. And this contrasts a lot when you see him as a kid, where he makes a lot of mistakes out of youthful naivete. But he's very faithful, and he's makes a lot of promises, and he's very different to adult Gabriel in a lot of obvious ways in which you're supposed to pay a lot of attention to. Like, for example, as a young man, as like a 16-year-old boy, he refuses all alcohol because his stepfather was a drunk. But Gabriel, when he's like 32, is an alcoholic.
So, Geordie, kind of take me back then, because I remember Day's death. I remember the plot arc of him, you know, how do I say plot arc? I know that he becomes trained as this vampire hunter, but how do we get, just jog my mind, young boy in a village, how does he get to vampire killing school?
Dave's death happens, and listen, Duncan, when you're a young man, your body starts to go through some changes, and these are all very natural. You know, you start to grow hair and unusual parts of your body. You start to have strange urges. You're going to start to be more interested in girls. And you're going to want to pierce their skin with your teeth and drink their unholy blood.
Well, we had different childhoods, but okay.
These are all natural changes, and you shouldn't be ashamed. That's a lie, no. Gabriel de Leon discovers that he is an abomination, that his soul is cursed. He was fathered not by the man he thought he was fathered, but by a vampire. He attacks a girl, you know, driven by dark urges for blood that he doesn't understand. And he's press-ganged into the Order Argent, basically being like, listen, if we let you go, you're going to go mad with desire for blood. You're going to kill someone, and then we're going to put you down like a monster, because you will be a monster. Or we can fashion you into a weapon against evil. And naturally, he chooses to be a weapon against evil. He's inducted into this fighting order of holy brothers. They're like paladins, you know. They are both fighting men and priests, basically, protected by faith. And this is where the influences start to become quite apparent, because, one, they're kind of paladin-y, but they're also mostly witches, you know? They're witches. They're part human, they're part monster. They have the tool belts full of, like, different potions and elixirs and special weapons and bombs. They have silver swords. They're witches. J. Christoph relied on a pretty broad array of stuff he likes from fantasy. We mentioned earlier that he's very similar to Elric. He's got pale skin. He's got a magic talking sword at a certain point in the book. He's called the Black Lion instead of the White Wolf, which, come to think of it, Geralt is also called.
Yeah, and Jon Snow from Game of Thrones. Very popular moniker, that
one. Is he actually called the White Wolf?
He is indeed.
Isn't Rob's called the Young Wolf? I don't think he's called the White Wolf, is he?
No, Rob Stark's called the Young Wolf. Jon Snow's called the White... That's what I said. Jon Snow's called the White Wolf. You're right, sorry.
That's what... I'm confused. I clearly haven't read Game of Thrones for a while. We mentioned how we have these two stories that weave in and out. Gabriel is a young man, and the Battle of the Twins. It's all the lead up to this amazing victory that he leads. It's this moment where he begins his career, not merely as a vampire hunter, but as like a hero known throughout the realm. And it's also the beginning of his fall from grace. He starts off as being really idealistic and faithful and true to his word and a good kid who makes some mistakes. And then he falls. He falls in love with a girl, Astrid, who's a nun. A very unwilling nun with a foul mouth, but who's very pretty and fills his head with bad ideas. He falls for her, and then eventually, after that whole story is done, she falls pregnant, and he's cast out of the order. He's abandoned, and he leaves the battle against the darkness. And that story is the most straightforward fantasy adventure part. You know, it's stuff you've seen before, but it's fun. It's really enjoyable to just see cool vampire hunts. And
I mean, would you describe it, Geordie, as just special person goes to special school to learn to be special. Like, we said this a lot of time with Red Sister and Poppy War. Is it that?
It's pretty similar. Yeah, it's pretty similar. Like, for one thing, it even comes down to the fact that, like, he's initially dismissed as weaker than everyone else. They call him a frail blood because he doesn't have one of the special powers from his vampiric father. But it turns out that actually, no, he's super duper special because he's a descendant of a lost, forgotten, forbidden, super powerful, evil bloodline, the Asani, the Faithless. And he has sanguomancy powers where he can control blood, which allows him to destroy really powerful vampires. So yes, he's a special boy who goes to a special school. He breaks the rules, but it turns out he was right to break the rules.
And would you say this ranks, like, fairly in terms of those plots?
It's...
Or low or bad?
It's better than all the ones you mentioned. But that's just my opinion. I mean, listen, a lot of people like Red Sister, and I don't like Red Sister. But I think people who like Red Sister probably would like Empire the Vampire, because they're also edgy and dark and bloody. But this book's more tongue-in-cheek than Red Sister. Basically... At least both series have a lot of anime influence, I think. We talked a lot about how that's basically just Naruto. There's some, like, cool Naruto kung fu fighting in this. So, yeah, maybe you'll like it.
And that's about half the novel is special school.
That's right. But the other half...
Unlike something like Poppy War, where we get it up front, this is evenly spaced out. We're, like, jumping between the two plots.
Yeah, and it's not just set at school. It's partially set there, but it's mostly set... going on missions and
like a Naruto
like a Naruto, that's right. It's partially they go on a mission and then they come back and there's some downtime and he talks to Astrid and this other nun he knows called Chloe who shows up later in the story, and they uncover this vampiric conspiracy to sneak the king of the vampires, his army, over the border, and they have to thwart it, and they discover there's a traitor in the ranks. It's all just enjoyable, simple, direct, gothic fantasy. The other half of the book is deliberately set up to be in contrast, and the way in which this works is that you get to a really exciting part of the origin story, and just when you're on tenterhooks, you switch. You say, oh my god, and then they ran into a super duper powerful vampire who was going to crush them. And Gabriel says, I'm bored of this story, I'm going to go over to this one. And it's at this point when there is a serious problem I have with Empire the Vampire. And that is, there are times when it is a bit up its own arse.
Okay. I mean, I'm going to call it, I'm in a bit being delightfully smug.
Smug is a good word. There are parts of this book which are very smug or smarmy. There's a refrain which Jean-Francois says to Gabriel as he's telling a story, and he swaps, you know, between narratives. He says, this is not how stories are supposed to be told, looking directly at the audience. Ooh, aren't I being avant-garde by switching up the telling of a story in between two different threads spanned over 20 years? Great job, man. Just fucking filleting yourself on the page.
I know drawing attention to it might be in a bit of bad taste, but I do like the fact that we are getting them. I remember, like, getting them side by side and thinking, well, it does build up, like, those little cliffhangers and those moments of tension. And it also reminds me of one of the reasons, like, I really enjoyed, say, Song of Ice and Fire, whereas this book's jumping between time periods, that was jumping between characters. And it meant that each character story, you would have these moments of, oh my god, how is Arya going to get out of this next? And then you quickly have to flick through how long you need to go until you get back to that character. I remember having a similar vibe of being like, oh, where are we leaving off with school? Flick, flick, flick. Okay, I've got to get through the next bit of Grail. And then we'll be back.
Yeah, and the way it works is that you're initially like, oh man, I'm really annoyed. I'm not going to be able to find out. He ran into this ancien vampire, and how is he going to get out of this? Oh, now we're back with the Grail. Oh, I kind of wish I was back in his childhood bit. But then you get to even to that, and there's another cliffhanger. You go, oh man, they fell off a cliff. What am I going to do? That was a huge reveal. Oh, now we're back to him being a kid again. But then once you do that, you're like, oh wait, but I was really excited to find out what happened next when he was a kid. So I'm not too mad about that. And the way in which the two stories like play out of each other, it really works well with the way he divulges information. Because it's all being told as a series of flashbacks, and it's just a change in how far back it goes, there's a lot of dramatic irony. Like, on a reread, it's really obvious how much stuff the author is just telling you ahead of time. Like, it tells you, why is Gabriel on a quest for revenge in the Grail storyline? If you just read it, it will tell you on the page. It tells you what happened at the end of the Battle of the Battle of the Twins, the end of his, like, being a kid storyline, if you just read it, because that has happened for adult Gabriel. And if you read between the lines, you're like, yeah, it's so obvious, he already told me how it ends. And the way in which, say, for example, Astrid is a good example. When she's first introduced, she's a kid. And then later, you jump forward in time, and before he's even had a conversation with Astrid, he runs into Chloe, Astrid's best friend, and we reveal that not only is Astrid important to him, she's his wife and the mother of his child. So before we even have a proper conversation between the two of them, we know where the story ends up, and that creates dramatic weight. We're like, okay, so how are they going to get along? Because right now they don't have a relationship. So it works well in which the ways these stories twist in and out of each other. And I'm really interested to see how that plays into the next book and how it plays with time in that one as well.
It certainly, looking back, gave it enough added value that I don't remember ever being like, God, this is 600 pages. Can you just give me a 300-page special school story followed by a 300-page adventure quest story?
Absolutely. It's not like the Poppy War where you could just chunk, slice it down the middle and be like, yeah, that works. They're incomplete without the other, and they're improved by the other half existing. It is a bit frustrating when you do those jumps, but it was less frustrating in my second read through. Now, the Grail storyline. This is when he's a very jaded 32-year-old old man. He feels, you know, he's risen to be like a 32-year-old who feels like a 48-year-old. He's bitter and he's brooding and he's sardonic and he's faithless. He can no longer activate like his silver armor because he doesn't believe in God anymore. Something has happened, and there's this mystery that runs throughout the book. Which, like I said, on a reread, it's like so obvious. But I remember reading through the first time, trying to figure out actually what is it. Because this is the interesting thing. The book constantly lies to you. It lies to you in ways in which are obvious on the read through. But when you read it the first time, you're like, okay, well, I know this can't have happened. Because they told me it couldn't have. Because you're for fucking... You're being told a story by Gabriel, who is a liar.
You've danced around a fact. I actually struggle to remember what this is in reference to.
Okay, sure.
What did they lie to us about?
So basically, there's this refrain. Chloe goes up to Gabriel when she runs to him for the first time at a bar, and she tries to get him to join her quest to find the Holy Grail. And she asks him, where is Astrid and Patience? Patience is the name of their daughter. And he says, they're at home. And so, when you learn that, you go, okay, so they're alive, because he said they're at home. But they're not, because his wife keeps following him around as a vampire. So you know she's at least dead, but you don't know what's happened to Patience. What happened to Patience?
Oh, she's dead too, isn't she?
That's right. So, spoiler, I guess, but Patience is dead, and we only learn later, like right towards the end of the book, what happened. And that, you know, there's all these scenes where Gabriel's wife shows up and, like, drinks his blood, and he has to invite her in. But right towards the end, we find out that actually that's not real either. That's like he's mentally ill. He's imagining that she's following him around. It's grief that makes him think that she's pursuing him, because she was turned into a vampire, and then he killed her.
I actually remember that. This is much darker than
I had in mind. It's a dark book, man!
I remember the kung fu fighting and the swords flying around and it being like a scene out of Highlander.
It is. It's a lot like if Highlander was also Wolverine, because all of the vampires and like half vampires, the pale bloods like Gabriel, all have like healing factors. So he gets stabbed through the chest a lot in the book. It's a scene where he falls under the ice and Dior stabs through the ice and sticks him on the blade and like jams him in place. And like it hurts, obviously, but he doesn't die. He just gets better.
I like it when your main character can take a little bit more abuse. The thing is, though, it works with this character because we already know he's going to survive. Like, that's not the question.
And not only do we know he's going to survive, we know he fails. Like, everything he does, all the triumphs where you punch your fist in the air like, yes, they did it. You know it's all for nothing. So there's this great dramatic irony to the whole thing. You see Gabriel learn to believe again. And then but he's in the present and he doesn't believe still. So, dark. The last thing this book, you're reading of this book, is the author's note where a description of the author, where you learn that J. Christoph, a couple of things. He's Australian, he's an author, he's 6'7", and he doesn't believe in happy endings.
I mean, I see how the first and the last fact feed into this, but don't know how his height impacts much.
Listen, I just think that's what it says in the book. I don't know what to tell you, man.
That's upsetting, because I genuinely have this sort of gut feeling. I'm like, no, there must be something else.
That's the great thing about the book.
But it genuinely, from what I recall, if I had to make a pitch for like the next book, and I don't know, but if I had to make a guess, I really want it to be like this moment of the vampires like gloating like, oh, you failed. How could you be? Tell me about your failures. And I really want it to be some sort of scene of like, he's still pulling the wool over their eyes the whole time. Like, why would Gabriel just give up and tell his story?
Well, and I will tell you this later. I will talk about that later, because that's the hope. That's the hope you have throughout the whole book. You're like, but surely no. Surely you didn't actually lose. You've got to be pulling the wool over his eyes, right? You won, didn't you? And you're reaching out for this hope, and that's the thing. That's the really clever thing the book does, is that it doesn't ask you to believe in the same things as the characters, but it evokes that same desire to believe, to hope that everything will work out, that things aren't all bad, that there is still a chance. I think that's like the most impactful thing it does. It has issues with that, like Gabriel's version of atheism is quite an edgy 15-year-old idea of atheism. Like, he goes on these, like, he insults members of the clergy and, like, he makes these, like, disparaging jokes. And it's all stuff that I said when I was 15, 16 years old. But Gabriel's not 15, 16 years old at that point in the book. And it kind of reads like it's pitching towards, like, that juvenile audience, when the book is not otherwise that juvenile.
I find it really interesting, this idea that the character would have such, like, this strong atheism when he's seen the power of faith. Like, that's objective. He knows those that believe have some sort of extra magical power.
Yeah, when you hold up a piece of silver that is shaped like a religious symbol and you believe in the power of God and you're in the presence of evil, it shines with silver light and it hurts the damned. That's empirical truth. And Gabriel's version of belief is not non-theism, it's atheism. He hates God. He thinks God is evil.
I kind of do get how he's arrived at that. To be fair, I do, in his world.
Yeah, it's a sucky world. It's not fun to live in. There's fungus everywhere. There's vampires eating all your friends.
And
he's done all these great campaigns and he lost.
Yeah, and I do get why he would be annoyed, not only at the idea of like God, but also the church that represents them on Earth.
Yeah.
Because this church is represented as a sucky church, that even in these dire times is still being an arsehole to other human beings.
Yeah, it's very much, again, it's Catholicism, so there's a lot of guilt built into it. There's a lot of like flagellation and confession and the repressal of feelings. One of his best friends throughout the book, they start as mortal enemies and they become good friends, and it's very heartening, is Aaron DeCoste. And Aaron DeCoste is cast under the order for being gay when he's caught with his lover, Baptiste. And they're such great characters, especially when they're together, that you get really upset because you're like, well, this is bullshit. That guy killed so many fucking vampires for you. And now you're going to cast him out because he's gay? And, like, Gabriel is implied at several points in the story to be bisexual. But that's a part of himself he has to repress because of the church.
Oh, so you said, you know, it's juvenile how he throws it out, but are you still like, it's worked in such a way you're like, I get it, but it's not how you represent it? Is that more the angle?
It's more that it's cringy. It's a bit cringy to be like, listen, these are not strong arguments against religion or power of faith. And it kind of feels, and it just feels a bit weak sauce when he could actually have some good ammunition. But the fact is, the matter is that that's wrong. Like, Gabriel, this is written from his perspective, and he's going on these screeds, and it's kind of embarrassing. But he's textually wrong in the course of the book. Like, the book doesn't agree with him. It wants to show that he's in a dark place, and that he needs to get over this, and, like, find something to hold on to find faith in. But it doesn't work because it kind of feels like it's pitched towards, like, a juvenile teen audience, as opposed to, like, the adults who are reading your book, because it's a book that teens could read, but it is probably for adults.
Okay, so I remember a lot of those moments. Jody, there's a bit in this book that really stands out to me, and I think it links into this sort of conversation piece. I want you to maybe jog me, have I got this right? Because I remember this really cool moment in this book, where there's a priest and he's holding back like a super powerful vampire, like high blood
Danton Voss.
And there's this great moment where the vampire's like, if you truly believe your God will protect you, toss away your holy symbol.
Yes, exactly. I know why you remember this, because in our first episode, you went on about this scene for a bit because you loved this scene. Because it is a great scene. That's the scene that happens. Danton Voss, this evil vampire, he's a son, he's a prince of forever. And I haven't mentioned this so far, but like, the oldest vampire in the world is called the King of Forever, Fabian Voss. And he's like basically indestructible. He's so powerful. He's lived for like a thousand, maybe over a thousand years. And yeah. And he has these, like, seven children who are, like, these uber evil, powerful vampires. And they all have, like, weird, distinct personality traits and legends behind them. And Danton Voss is, like, the principal antagonist in one half of the book. The Grail part of the book. That is a good scene. Per Rafa is the most sincere, true believer in the book. He's uncompromising, he's faithful, he has lived a life outside. He's had his faith tested in the past by love. Like, something that might have, like, he passed Gabriel's test. Gabriel succumbed to love, and he left the church. Per Rafa, faith won over for him. And so he persisted, and he stayed this true, faithful man. And there's this scene, Duncan, as you've said.
Oh, Jordy, this scene has played on my mind for 2 years. So in this scene, he has this moment, he's holding it, and the vampire's like, toss it away, if your faith is that strong and your God will protect you. And he hesitates, and he doesn't. And that's what gives the vampire the power to ultimately defeat him, because he's like, oh, you don't have so much faith, you don't need like a talisman, like a holy symbol. And he goes on, oh, if you just tossed it away, you know, even I could never have touched you.
Mm-hmm.
But Jordan, this plays in my mind so much, though, because I'm like, but if faith alone was the power, you wouldn't need holy symbols to begin with.
And that's, I mean, maybe that's the case. Maybe it's just like a chemical reaction between something and the power of silver. But what's really good about the scene, I think why it stood out to you, is that the narrative saying, if Per Rafa could have held on, he could have held off even Danton Voss, a prince of forever. That comes from Gabriel. Faithless Gabriel. Gabriel who doesn't believe, but he believes in Per Rafa. He thinks so highly of Per Rafa, a man he constantly ridicules throughout the rest of the book. And he respects him enough that deep down he knows that he could have stood up to him if only he hadn't failed for that one moment where his faith flickers.
But it's a good scene. If you're the faithful, why would you listen to a vampire? You just be like, no, I don't believe in you. I believe in faith.
Yeah, there's a saying in this book, and this book is full of cool, like, laws and sayings. Like, their second law, the Vampire Hunters, the Ordre Argent, is dead tongues heeded are dead tongues tasted. Don't listen to the dead.
So it's not necessarily about the throwing the talisman away or holding on to it. It was just having a doubt whether or not that would work.
Well, it came down to faith. Like, if his faith was unshakable, he would have lived. But, so, Peyrafa belongs to one half of the book. A part of the book we haven't talked about yet, because the first time I read it through, I didn't like this section as much. Reading it through again, I liked it a lot more. And that is the Grail Quest. The Grail Quest works, it hinges on one thing and one thing only. To begin with, it's fine. It's fine. Gabriel joins in with a merry band of true believers from all walks of life. None of them are as cool or good at fighting as him, and he's literally just using them to lure in Danton Voss so he can kill him as revenge against the Forever King. But slowly, you know, Gabriel opens up his heart a little bit to them, just a little bit. He becomes responsible for this young man, Dior Lachance, who Chloe Sauvage, his, you know, the nun, is super protective of for some reason. You meet these cool characters like Saoirse. Is it Saoirse or Saoirse? How do you say that name?
I mean, I'm going to go Saoirse, but I haven't seen it written down for many a moon.
Well, it's written down wrong. It's like a weird Scottish name. Babe! Headphones off. I need to ask you a question. How do you pronounce the name? Is it Saoirse? Saoirse? How do you pronounce that?
Saoirse.
Saoirse. Thank you. Put your headphones back on. All right. Thank you, honey.
It's okay.
Saoirse. You meet cool characters like Saoirse, who's like a barbarian fighter from like the Scottish part of the French Empire, and her mountain lion Phoebe. And then there's characters who are not quite as strong, because you also have Bellamy, and Bellamy's like the bard character, and he's not like a D&D magic bard. He's a guy who has a lute, and he's not allowed to be a good character. Because every time he tries to, like, sing or express his emotions, Gabriel tells him to shut the fuck up. And it's obvious that this is, like, a joke. You know, he's not being allowed to do his own thing, to be the bard he's supposed to be, because Gabriel is such a cynical asshole. But it means that I'm never actually able to connect with Bellamy until the very end. And I know that's the point, but it's still not very satisfying, because there's this great bit where Bellamy, like, in a moment of deep despair, when they've seen this great act of brutality take place, he plays a song finally, he's finally allowed to play, and it's this beautiful dark dirge that brings the tears to everyone's eye, including Gabriel. And then he dies. Like, Bellamy's killed in the next chapter. And that's tragic. It's pathos. And I wish I got to like Bellamy more, because he's never permitted to be more than that.
I think it's so telling, Jordy, that you're telling me about these characters, and even the barbarian, Scottish barbarian with the mountain lion, I'm just shroking my beard like, no, I don't remember them. I remember the priest.
They are not in.
I remember Chloe, and I remember Dior, and that's it.
And the reason why you remember Dior is that Dior and Gabriel are the only survivors of the what are they called? They're not the Fellowship of the Grail, but there's something similar to that. Like the Company of the Grail. They're the only survivors, because they're destroyed by Danton Voss. Gabriel and Dior are the only ones to escape. Dior and Gabriel have butted their heads the whole time that they've known each other. They despise each other. But Chloe makes Gabriel promise to protect Dior. They jump from a cliff, they land in a river. He rescues Dior from drowning. And as he, like, pulls Dior from the river, what does he discover at the very turn before he goes back? It jumps back again to the past, so we get this big cliffhanger. Dior Lachance is not, as we thought, a 14-year-old boy, but a 16-year-old girl. And the rest of the book, once we get back to the present, is the, you know, it's The Last of Us, and it's Bioshock Infinite, and it's The Mandalorian Season 2. It's Gruff Warrior Protects Small Baby. It's God of War, it's Wolverine, it's Logan, it's Lone Wolf and Cub. It's a very, very familiar story.
It's not bad, as I recall, but it's certainly not as interesting as I think the younger bits of the story, the special school.
Yes, the reason why, Duncan, is that it's much more familiar. I started with The Last of Us, because it's very like The Last of Us. They even end up in a forest filled with fungus, which has like infected people and turned them into like crazed monster zombies. I clarified in our first time doing this episode that specifically I know that it's not ripping off The Last of Us. It's actually ripping off Darkest Dungeon, a video game I love. And there's a whole bunch of stuff in that book which is specifically Darkest Dungeon. Saoirse, for example, is designed after the character of the Hellion. She even has like a similar axe, she has similar makeup, she has a similar design. This like evil halo which appears above some characters' heads is very similar to like the stress symbol from Darkest Dungeon. The blight monsters are similar. The location in which it happens is called the Weald, which is the same blighted location in Darkest Dungeon. So yeah, there's a scene in that where they're riding a horse and it falls off a cliff and the horse dies and it's super cold, so he cuts it open and he stuffs Dior inside so she doesn't freeze to death. And that, not only is that a scene from Empire Strikes Back, but it's very, very similar to the same scene in The Revenant. It has a lot of similarity to other stuff. And for the most part in the book, the stuff it draws inspiration from is not distracting. But in that part of the book, it is a bit like, listen, this is a bit too much. Like, Ash Drinker, the talking sword, is great. She's a great addition to the book. She works really well. I'm not bothered by the fact that it's not remotely original to have a talking sword who has a divisive relationship with a main character. That's fine. But when wholesale scenes get taken from other books, especially the ending, it kind of rubs me the wrong way a little bit.
It's that kind of beautiful kind of line between paying homage and ripping off, or simply doing a trope and directly copying. Like, the reason why I think I give so much like slack to that special school story, the other half of this book, is because loads of books do it. No one owns it. There's not one piece you can go, that's what it is, or the special someone. Like, it's just a trope and people can put their own spin on it and give it their own settings, and it can work time and time again. But you're right, it's when you look at this and you go, I know you, or I know this scene. And I think
there's a bit in a quite famous, at this point, video essay by H. Moore Guy, Plagiarism in YouTube, where he talks about the Yoinkin twist, and about how there's a difference between, say, ripping someone off wholesale, and like taking an idea and putting your own spin on it. So like, you've seen Magical Special School, but you probably haven't seen Magical Special Catholic School with nuns and vampire hunters with special tattooed ink, which takes some cool stuff from The Witcher and makes them hunt vampires and elves as well, and a weird Tristan werewolves. That's probably kind of new. But to say, for example, the end of the book is a bit too, this is just the end to The Last of Us. Because once Gabriel finds out that Dior is not a boy, but a girl, his perspective on her changes a lot. And whilst they still butt heads, he's much more affectionate and he cares about her a lot more because of his deep, deep psychic damage around the fact that his wife and daughter were killed, which is eventually revealed in a scene which is not as sad as the author probably thinks it is, but it is well written and dramatic. But at the end of the book, after the vampire, Danton Voss is defeated, after a big showdown, after they finally make it to San Michon, which they've been going for this whole time, it's revealed, dun dun dun, Catholicism is bad, actually. And that they believe Oh, I completely forgot to mention Dio is the Holy Grail. I gotta add that in somewhere, shit. The two main twists are that Dior is a girl, yes, but the other twist is that Dior is the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail is not a cup, it's like metaphorical. The blood in her veins is the blood of a Redeemer, their Jesus.
Right, did that originate in Da Vinci Code? Was that been an idea for years and years and years and years?
I have never read the Da Vinci Code, and I never will read Da Vinci Code, so I don't know what to tell you, man. That generally was a spoiler, I didn't know about that. It probably is from the Da Vinci Code, because isn't there a thing in the Da Vinci Code about how, like, Jesus has a descendant who's the child of Mary Magdalene?
It is, yeah, it's exactly that. It's the Da Vinci Code, so yeah, from Master Sword for Da Vinci Code, it's one of the best-selling books of 2004. It's the whole, the Honor Grail quest, and at the very end, they realise it was a person the whole time.
I mean, ta-da. Yeah, it's a rip-off of Da Vinci Code, but who the fuck cares about that?
In fact, it was in the same context where it's like the younger female companion to the lead.
Mm.
And it's like, oh my god, it was you. That's why we had to do on this. Anyway, sorry. Back to Empire of the Vampire.
So it is a ripoff of the Da Vinci Code. I didn't realise that, but I don't care about ripping off the Da Vinci Code. That's not important. It's probably better than this. I don't know. I'm not going to find out. Anyway, Dior is actually the descendant of the Redeemer. Her blood has like magical healing powers. And they believe that she's the key to ending Day's death. And the reason why the end of this book is so much like The Last of Us is that they think that by sacrificing her, by spilling her blood, that will be the end to Day's death. And it will end the blight of the vampires. And Gabriel is like, fuck that. And he tries to stop them. They slit his throat, they throw him off a mountain, and he's brought back to life by a vampire who feeds him her blood. She's been following them throughout the book. She's been this enemy who's fought them numerous times, tried to kill him, and it's revealed that this vampire is his dead younger sister, who he thought had been killed out of vengeance from a vampire which he had stopped. And she's alive, or not alive, she's dead, but with a capital D. And then she's like, okay, I can't go onto holy ground to save her, but you have to stop them because that will not end Day's death. We need Dior alive. Get back in there. And Gabriel storms back into the castle, busts down the doors of the cathedral as they're about to do this holy ritual, and kills all his holy brothers, the people he's fought alongside with for years. He draws his sword and he cuts them down one by one, including his own master. And it's full of corny but really good one-liners where he's having a showdown with his master, and his master goes, I told you, Gabriel, it's wrong, it's no good to be a hero. Heroes die horrible deaths far from home. And Gabriel says, who the fuck told you that I was a hero? And he stabs him through the heart. And then he goes up to Chloe, who's about to plunge a dagger into Dior, and says, we must do this, Gabriel. It's all a part of his plan. And he says, fuck his plan. And he kills Chloe and he saves Dior.
Now, I think there's a lot to be said.
Edgy, good fun.
Yes, for edgy, good fun. And it kind of makes me, like, we talk about, like, when it's ripping it off and something off, and you're like, well, this is a direct comparison. It sort of makes me in mind of maybe something like, I don't know, the Belgarde. Not like a particularly original work. It's very taking things from, like, Lord of the Rings. But if you just do it well enough, I can get over it. And I think that's my main thing with the tropes, particularly in this scene. It's like, it's obvious, but I felt it was done just well enough. I'm like, okay, cool. Yeah.
On the reread, I like this more.
All right.
The first time through, I was a bit like, not sure about that. It's a bit too close to The Last of Us. But actually,
the only real... Oh, I was about to say.
Yeah?
Are you about to say the point I'm about to say, which is, actually, there's a difference.
No, go ahead. You tell me what difference is.
So, I think the difference, though, in this scene, which does make it give it a slightly different kind of tone than something like The Last of Us... And I'll be honest, it's been a long time since I played The Last of Us as well. So that's a hard memory game. But in this scene, we're told very specifically that, from I would say a reliable source, that what's about to happen to Dior won't work.
Yeah, that's true. That is a difference.
Like,
And that makes it much less impactful.
We know that he needs to save them. Like, and he's in the right.
Yes.
Despite the fact he's cutting down his companions, they are doing the wrong thing. Whereas something in The Last of Us, I believe they leave it ambiguous.
Yeah.
I don't think they necessarily say that, like, this might actually save the world. And it has a little bit more of a different way.
And
where
it,
we're like, no.
And it doesn't matter.
Get in there.
It doesn't matter. There's a wonderful... The wonderful thing about the end of The Last of Us is that you're not doing it because they're in the wrong. You're doing it because this is what Joel wants to do. He loves this girl too much. He's become like a father to her. And he murders innocent doctors. Sorry, not innocent doctors. He murders unarmed doctors in order to do this. Like, you don't have to. There are ways to play the game where you don't kill him, I'm pretty sure. I've never spared those doctors. I've fucking gunned them down.
They might have had a scalpel, but, mate. You know, that counts.
That's dangerous. Bang, 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 bang! No, but the point is that at that point in the game, you're Joel. You're in the head of Joel. And you're like, yeah, of course you're going to kill him. Of course you are, because you're fucking crazy. And that's who you are. And there's nothing that's going to get in the way of you protecting this girl. Because that's what you've done for the entire game. Why would I stop now? The fact that it won't work. The fact that it's... That you have to do this to save the world. That's way less impactful than it being like, Gabriel just doesn't care about this piece of people ideas. I'll find another way, but you're not doing it this way. I'm not going to let you pay this price.
And that's where we kind of leave off. Gabriel kind of takes Dior out of the bloody cathedral. And we come back to the present. Mm-hmm. The framing narrative of this.
And he lost. It's lost. Dawn comes and the vampire's like, okay, you're going to go back to your cell now. We'll come back later for the sequel. And you have this persistent idea that, you know, Gabriel has lost. And the last thing that Gabriel does as vampire is he grabs him by the throat and he tries to, like, torch him to death. He's like, I'm not stuck in here with you, you're stuck in here with me. Another kind of ripped off line. He fails to kill the vampire and he's like trapped in his cell again. And the image you're left with as the book closes is that he has all these tattoos. He's got the black lion in his chest, he's got angels on him, but tattooed across his knuckles is the name Patience. And the wonderful thing about it is that when you're first introduced to this, it's connected to religious iconography. So you think of this as a purely a sign of, like, it's a virtue. Patience is a heavenly virtue. Like, it's a, like, an antithesis to the deadly sins. And then later, you're like, oh, this is his daughter's name. That's why he's got a tattooed there. But the motif throughout the book, as he drums his knuckles, is drawing attention to the word patience. And the last thing he does in the book, as he waits in his cell, as the sun rises, as the vampires go to bed and they play with their mortal subjects who they completely control, in the world that is theirs now, he keeps tapping on his knuckles the word patience. And you, despite it all, you still believe, surely, there must be more going on. What isn't Gabriel telling us?
It was a fun book. And despite
it having forgotten... It is a fun book, and I'm very excited to finish the book, the sequel.
So many details. I'm glad you two have brought me back up to speed. I'm ready. Next week, we are going to jump in to Empire of the Damned, which I don't actually know how many there's meant to be. I'm not expecting an ending. So, I think this is an ongoing series. I don't know if it's a trilogy or just as long as it takes.
So, I will tell you this. I'm enough of the way into Empire of the Damned where I thought... When I finished Empire of the Vampire, I thought it was going to be a duology. When I started Empire of the Damned, I thought it was a duology. I'm now far enough in that I've realized it cannot be a duology because of the pace it's going. And then... I flipped to the very back page where it tells me once again that the author is 6'7" and he doesn't believe in happy endings. And it says he's the author of the Empire to Vampire trilogy. And I was like, oh, fuck. Okay, fine. I thought this was going to be the last one, but I was wrong.
I'm probably going to be here for the whole trilogy, Geordie. Because
I think so too.
This has some style. And that it might be silly. It might rip off. It might be tropey. But it has it with just enough of itself flair that I... Mm-hmm. think, and if that flare keeps going, we're going to have a really solid trilogy on our hands.
And that earnest core. And there's one more thing about it, which I haven't drawn as much attention to as I should have. But basically, the experience of reading this book is that it really makes you wish there was an Empire the Vampire tabletop role-playing game.
What, where we all roll up as Silver Saints?
Exactly. I mean, I guess if you played the game, you should have the option to play as a human, because most of the people in the book are, like, the Company of the Grail are all human, but they all get their butts kicked, and they don't have special healing factors, so it would probably be a pretty wonky game if you could play as a Silver Saint, or you could play as a human, but you didn't have any special healing powers. So yeah, probably mostly Silver Saints. But like, the tools they have, and like, the special powers they can get, and the powers the bad guys have, and the list of enemies they have, and the dramatic fighting scenes. Yeah, you're like, oh god, I wish I could roll up a character and fight vampires like this. With silver bombs, and like, special drugs, like Sanctus, the vampire blood. It's great.
Do you know what? I'd like to see it. I'm sure. I know there's a big vampire RPG out there. I think it's like Vampires of the Masquerade. It's
the big one. It's a very different game.
Okay. Fair enough. I know very little about it. But this is what I would want to explore. To be honest, looking at the visuals and the motifs, like, I want a video game as well. I'd be just as happy. Just to be like, just dive in and just fight with this flair. And there's so much sort of like it, but nothing quite the same. I think that's what it's done. It's pulling from all these styles.
Yeah, there's a lot of Bloodborne in here too, but like, only in terms of aesthetic, not in terms of like, the way it feels.
And so, I'm glad it's, you know, 2 years on, I can still remember bits of it, and I can still remember these scenes, like the priest scene, where I'm like, that was cool. I like that. Let's have some more.
Yeah.
I'm excited to get more.
And we shall have some more next time.
So, thank you everyone for listening. Thank you, Geordie, for taking the time to reread and talk for the vast majority of this episode and bring us all up to speed. If you guys listening...
That's okay. I don't think I did a good job. I genuinely forgot about his sister until the very last minute, and I should have flagged that up earlier.
Well, if anyone listening also appreciated, Geordie, this recap for us, why not give us 5 stars on Spotify, or a thumbs up, or however it is on the platform you listen to us to. And while you're at it, jump over to our Instagram, where we'll give out a couple of extra posts on what we've been reading along the way. And it's also a great place to go to know when a new episode drops.
Alrighty, well, I've been your host, Geordie Bailey, and I completely forgot to sprinkle occasional French words into this episode. I completely failed. Mad.
On to the next one. I've been your host, Duncan Nicol.
I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
Bye.
Bye-bye.